Welcome to Subtle Beast, everybody. I am your host, Volt, sitting here with my co-host and main man, Mr. Steve Apostolopoulos. Steve, welcome back to Studio 1B.
Thank you very much, Matthew. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing great. I can't complain. I'm glad that we're back here in the studio doing a podcast. Had some personal family issues, but everything's all right, correct?
Yep, everything is good now and back on the scene, crispy and clean, man.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Well, that's amazing that everything's going good.
I got
to
ask you this, though.
Yeah.
How about that weather?
Wow, man. I'll tell you one thing. It was like hitting me like, well, I guess like Indian summer.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
I was, as a matter of fact, the one day I was like, it's supposed to be nice out today. Maybe I'm going to go up to the gun range and maybe have a little bit of fun. And prior to doing that, I took my dog for a walk. I came back. I was like, it's too hot.
It's like, too hot to go out and have fun.
Yeah, and at the end of September, but
So you think that was an Indian summer there?
I mean, I said it to my wife, and she said, well, I thought that was later in October. I was like, well, I mean, I'm sure you're right, but I don't know. I mean, it was irregularly warm.
Yeah, I'm sure she's right. But that word did pop into my mind. I thought to myself, is this the Indian summer or is there multiple Indian summers? And I really don't know enough about an Indian summer to talk
about. No, me neither. The one thing I did take notice to, though, is I don't know if anybody else has, but the gnats have just been, or the bugs. I mean, just, I don't know if it's because I have wooded area around my house, but we just go for a walk and we got to bring like punks. Remember punks when you were a kid?
Yeah, that's how my mom used to do the timer when we were back at the Nassau Trails. She would give me a punk and she would take a punk and she would say, all right, when that punk is burnt out, that means you have to come back here and meet me.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, it was like a little timer.
Yeah.
Like the sand in the hourglass.
Right. Yeah, I always liked punks. Now we just carry incense sticks. It's like, I don't think you can find the old punks anymore.
Well, we were at a wedding last Saturday, and I'm watching this beautiful ceremony occur in a vineyard at a winery, and the groom was just getting killed by gnats, and I thought to myself, man, that just sucks.
Yeah.
Those gnats were just like all over. Man, that's better him than me, but at the same
time. Well, yeah, because he's standing there, supposed to be the most important moment of his life, and he's probably just thinking, I can't wait to get out of here.
He's like swatting his hands over his head. When we pulled around the corner, I noticed that the setup was directly in the sun, and I was like, oh, man, that's going to take a lot out of me, because I'm on the Lamisil.
Right.
And one of the side effects, or one of the precautions, is to not put your skin directly in the sun, or to like put a bunch of lotion on yourself, if you know, the suntan lotion before you go out. So I went out with no suntan lotion, and I was just like getting fried.
Ugh.
It was probably 45 minutes I was sitting there, and then it was tough.
Yeah, on to the reception.
It was beautiful. Awesome wedding.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear it. Well, with it coming to the end of September, we have a lot of fun activities coming up. We're going to get back in the woods here starting this Saturday. And
You know, I just got that crossbow too, so I'm excited.
Oh, I know you are. So we're going to put it to the test. Who's smarter, man or beast? So
yep. if we can get them, or if they get us.
That's right. That's why it's called hunting and not just gathering. So, but, to switch gears real quick though, you know, I know that you're into technology just like I am. With thoughts on the new iPhone 8 coming out, or is it out? It might be out, and then the 10's coming out shortly.
Right. Boy, that the 10, the OLED screen looks like it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, it definitely does. I just can't figure out why they wanted to bring out the 8 and then 2 months later drop the 10. It's just,
it's almost like simultaneous. Like they have the 8, the 10, and there was like three models at the same time, and a new iPad. There was a whole lot of Apple stuff that just came out, and the features on them are fantastic.
Right. One thing that I got excited about was when they first came out with the Apple Watch, I thought that was going to be great, and then lo and behold, you find out you still have to carry your phone with you and things of that nature. But on the new one that's coming out, I guess the iPhone Watch 3, you don't have to have your phone with you. And that just sounds like something right up. One less thing to carry. Have everything right on my wrist. I'll be like a Knight Rider.
Yeah, it seems you would have the ability. Yeah, I mean, you pretty much have the ability to go phoneless, but it's like supplemental. Like you would want your phone for right. most of your stuff. But if you're like out on a jog, instead of missing that call or like having to have your phone with you to track your stuff, you now don't have to have any of that.
Or hunting example. I mean, you're sitting there rather than messing with your phone and here comes a big buck, you could just be messing with your wrist and then immediately go to your weapon. So, I mean, I could see that being useful.
If it paired with a Bluetooth earpiece, I think that would be like the best thing. I don't know if it does that or not, but if that Bluetooth earpiece, man, with the Siri connected together, you can pretty much do anything.
Oh yeah, I love the earpiece. I have it in all day long, taking phone calls for work and things of that nature, and I just really can't imagine without it. It's because I would either have to have my phone on speaker or up to my ear, and no thanks.
Right.
But yeah, so I guess some of the technology coming with the 10 is now not is it just going to be like a fingerprint scan or an eye scan. What they're coming out with is it's going to be like a whole facial recognition. Like within seconds of you putting your phone in front of your face, it can recognize who you are. And they say that there's like a 1 in a billion chance that somebody else's face would interface with that computer, I guess. It's crazy to me.
It's odd how technology drives itself. The thumbprint and the OLED screen did not work together. They couldn't put the sensor under the screen, and they couldn't use it because of the bezel. It's a bezel-less face, so they couldn't use that anymore. And they were like, well, now what are we going to do? They could have done the retinal scan. It just wasn't good enough, so they're doing a full facial recognition software package inside the iPhone X with 3-dimensional aspects. They got the 3D like futuristic stuff coming out. So cool, man.
It really is cool. And you know, I have to say that with the information coming out on the new iPhones, the 8 and the 10, was really almost set the premise for tonight's podcast, because you know, it had us discussing with each other when we had talked about it briefly, was the fact that, you know, now it's facial recognition. It's like, what's the iPhone 20 or 25 going to be like? Will it almost be, would you have the capacity to, or will technology caught up to the point where for you to unlock your phone, you're not just putting your face up to it, but you're just kind of like looking at your phone and using telepathy to unlock your phone.
You're just thinking about your password.
Right. And the more we looked into that, I think that we were shocked to find how much investigation and how much scientific testing is being done on that actual subject, the subject of, you know, what is the future of consciousness? Is telepathy and telekinesis something that we're going to be able to harness in the future and be able to use to, well, some could say help and some could say it could be a hindrance. But so that's what we're going to talk about tonight, is basically the evolution and the future of consciousness, dealing with telepathy and telekinesis, and what it could possibly do in, you know, in our future, in our everyday lives. So I'm going to let Steve kick it off here, and we're going to delve right into this.
So the brain, like it or not, is a machine. Scientists have come to the conclusion, not because they are killjoys, but because they have amassed evidence that every aspect of consciousness can be tied to the brain. Houdini, some historians believe, was the greatest magician that ever lived. His breathtaking escapes from locked, sealed chambers and death-defying stunts left audiences gasping. He could make people disappear and then reemerge in the most unexpected places, and he could read people's minds, or at least it seemed that way. Houdini took pains to explain that everything he did was actually an illusion. A series of clever sleight-of-hand tricks. Mind-reading, he would remind people, is impossible. He was so outraged that unscrupulous magicians would cheat wealthy patrons by performing cheap parlor tricks and seances that he took it upon himself to go around the country exposing fakes. He was even on a committee organized by Scientific American, which offered a generous reward to anyone that could positively prove they had psychic power. You know, no one ever picked up that reward. Houdini believed that true telepathy was impossible, but science is proving Houdini wrong. Telepathy is now the subject of intense research at universities around the world, where scientists have already been able to read individual words, images, and thoughts of our brain by combining the latest scanning technology with pattern recognition software. This could revolutionize the way we communicate with stroke and active accident victims who are locked in their bodies, unable to articulate their thoughts except through blinks of their eyes. But that's just the start. It might also radically change the way we interact with computers and the outside world. As we know, the brain is electrical. In general, anytime an electron is accelerated, it gives off an electronic radiation. The same holds true for electrons oscillating inside the brain. It sounds like something out of science fiction or fantasy, but humans naturally emit radio waves. These signals are too faint to be detected by others, and even if we could perceive these radio waves, it would be difficult for us to make sense of them. But computers are changing this. Scientists have already been able to get crude approximations of a person's thoughts using EEG scans. Subjects put on a helmet of EEG sensors on their heads and concentrate on certain pictures, say the image of a car or a house. The EEG signals were then recorded for each image, and eventually a rudimentary dictionary of thought was created, with a one-to-one correspondence between a person's thoughts and the EEG image. Then a person was shown a picture of another car, and the computer would recognize this EEG pattern. The advantage of EEG sensors is that they are non-invasive and quick. You simply put on a helmet containing many electrodes onto the surface of the brain, and the EEG scan can rapidly identify signals, which change every millisecond. But the problem with the EEG sensors, as we have seen, is that electromagnetic waves deteriorate as they pass through the skull, and it's difficult to locate precise source. This method can tell you if you're thinking of a car versus a house, but it cannot recreate the image of the car. That's where Dr. Galant's work comes in.
That is pretty impressive. And I have to say, I actually saw one of these EEG scans done on a television show. There's a television show called The Long Island Medium. So I don't know if anybody's familiar with that, but it's a favorite of ours in our house. And you know, the lady Teresa Caputo claims that she can speak with the dead. Now, I actually met Teresa Caputo once before, and she actually gave me a reading, and it, I have to say, this was after my father had passed away, and it was spot on. But not to switch gears, but she, I kind of want to stay on track. On her show, she put on one of these EEG scanning caps. It was almost like a rubber cap that had all these scans. And so then she started to channel a deceased family member of somebody that was in the room. And basically the EEG had concluded that with the patterns in her brain that she was actually talking to somebody that, you know, obviously nobody could see or hear or smell or touch, but the part of the brain was lit up signifying that she was actually having a conversation with somebody. So, I mean, that was pretty evident proof that, you know, that she is channeling, but whether you believe in that, you know, is up to you. But, yeah, it's, it just seems like technology is definitely going in the way of being able to read our thoughts and our minds. And The one thing that I think that this could possibly be the most useful for, I won't say most useful, but it would definitely help out a patient that was possibly in a coma. Because if you've ever been in a hospital room with somebody that's in a coma, if you're going to be discussing long-term care for this, the nurses usually say to you, you know, please wait in the hall because we're not sure if this person can hear what you're saying. So if you're technically in a coma, you know, maybe it was induced, maybe it wasn't, but if you're just kind of laying there but you can't communicate, but you can hear what people are saying and they're talking about, well, I guess we should pull the plug today, and you're screaming inside, no, I'm alive, I'm here. But with this type of technology, it could send off this computer. Oh, she's talking to us. Oh, it says, don't kill me. You know, that would be one of the scariest things to be. Well, there's no more brain activity. But you're thinking, oh, I'm here.
That's got to be a Twilight Zone episode.
Oh, right. So when you were finishing off there, you were talking about Dr. Galliant's work. And he's done some work with video of the mind, and the epicenter for much of the research was done at the University of California, Berkeley. That's where Dr. Galliant received his PhD in theoretical physics. This was years ago, though. He had the pleasure of touring the laboratory of Dr. Jack Galliant, whose group was accomplished a feat once considered to be impossible, videotaping people's thoughts. This is a major leap forward, reconstructing internal imagery. They are opening up a window into the movies of our mind, said Galliant. Now, when he visited his laboratory, the first thing that he noticed was a team of young, eager, postdoctoral and graduate students huddled behind their computer screens. And they were looking intently at a video image that was reconstructed from someone's brain scans. When he was talking to his team, he was feeling as though they were witnessing scientific history in the making. Now, Galliant explained that the subject lies flat on a stretcher, which is slowly inserted headfirst into a huge state-of-the-art MRI machine. And these things can cost upwards of like $3 million.
Jeez.
Now, the subject is then shown several movie clips, probably like YouTube movie trailers or whatever they had readily available. But they use this to accumulate enough data. And then you have to sit motionless for hours watching these clips. It has to be a truly arduous task. And one of the postdocs, Dr. Shinshi Nishimoto, had found volunteers who were willing to lie still for hours on end with only fragments of video footage to occupy the time. Now, what he said was the people in the room, the grad students and the postdocs, volunteered to be guinea pigs for their own research. But as subjects watched the movies, the MRI machine created a 3D image of the blood flow within the brain. So the MRI image looked like a vast collection of 30,000 dots or voxels. Now, each voxel represents a pinpoint of neural energy, and the color of the dot corresponds to the intensity of the signal and blood flow. Red dots represent points of large neural activity, while blue dots represent points of less activity. The final image looks very much like thousands of Christmas lights in the shape of a brain, basically. Immediately, you see the brain is concentrating most of its mental energy in this visual cortex while these people were watching these videos. Now, at first, the color 3D collection of dots, it looked like a bunch of gibberish to them, but they kept on, and after years of research, Dr. Gao and his colleagues had developed a mathematical formula which begins to make connections between certain features of a picture, like the edges and the texture and the intensity or, you know, what have you, and the MRI voxels. For example, if you look at a boundary, you'll notice its regions separating lighter and darker areas, and hence the edge generates a certain pattern of voxels. But by having a subject subject after subject view such large library of movie clips, this mathematical formula is refined. and is allowing the computer to analyze how all the sorts of images are converted into MRI voxels. Now, eventually, the scientists were able to ascertain a different correlation between certain MRI patterns of voxels in each picture. They were quoted as saying, "We built a model for each voxel that describes how space and motion information in the movie is mapped into the brain activity." This is what Nishimoto had said. And at this point, the patient is then showed another movie trailer while a computer analyzes the voxels generated during the viewing and recreates a rough approximation of the original image. The computer needs to select images from 100 movie clips that most closely resemble the one of the subject just saw and then merges images to create a close approximation. Now, in this way, the computer is able to create a fuzzy video of the visual imagery going through your mind. Now, Dr. Gallant's mathematical formula is so versatile that it can take a collection of MRI voxels and convert into a picture. Or it can do the reverse, taking a picture and then convert into MRI voxels. When he had a chance to view one of the videos, or when Nishimoto had a chance to view one of the videos created by Dr. Valiant's group, it was very impressive. Watching it was like viewing a movie through dark glasses with faces and animals and street scenes and buildings. Although you could not see the close-up detail, you could clarify the identity of the object that they were seeing.
I got to see one of those videos.
Yeah, I mean, it's just got to be... I mean, for the first time of them doing that, it just had to be astounding.
They were probably like, oh my God.
Yeah, look. And then, hey, what were you just thinking about? A cheetah? We saw a cheetah.
I saw a cheetah running across a field.
He was like, yeah, I was. Now, not only can this program decode what you're looking at, it can also decode images circulating in your head. Well, let's just say that you were asked to think of the Mona Lisa. Now, we know from MRI scans that even though you're not viewing the painting with your two eyes, the visual cortex of the brain will light up. Now, Dr. Gallant's program then scans your brain and flips through its data files of pictures, trying to find the closest match. And in one of the experiments, the computer selected a picture of actress Selma Hayek as the closest approximation to Mona Lisa. Now, of course, the average person can easily recognize hundreds of faces, but the fact that the computer analyzed an image within a person's brain and then picked out this picture from millions of random pictures at its disposal is still pretty impressive. And like we were saying during pre-show, we were like, well, Selma Hayek, we know what she looks like, and versus the Mona Lisa. And granted, that may seem pretty far off, but
it was a good point Foltz made. He said in that particular picture of Selma Hayek, she could have been posed in a similar manner to the Mona Lisa. Her hair could have been done in a similar manner to the Mona Lisa. Her cheeks could have been facing the camera in a similar manner to the Mona Lisa. So of all the pictures that computer analyzed, it could have just been that particular picture. I mean, we all know what Selma Hayek looks like. But in that particular picture, she could have very much resembled the same exact pose as the Mona Lisa.
Right. And if anybody were to say, well, that's a stretch to say that the computer got it close between Selma Hayek and the Mona Lisa. Well, the computer was able to read this person's mind and know that it was thinking of even just a woman. I mean, it didn't come up with some guy because, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, the picture of the Mona Lisa, I mean, you take away her long hair, it could be a man. I mean, because there's no real distinct big smile or whatever, but the fact that it even narrowed it down to a woman in the infancy of this technology, it's pretty incredible.
The Nikola Tesla pictures pop into my mind when I'm thinking of the Mona Lisa.
Yeah,
I easily picked that.
Definitely. Now, of course, they had goals in mind when they started this whole process, and it was to create an accurate dictionary that allows you to rapidly match an object in the real world with an MRI pattern in your brain. In general, a detailed match is very difficult and will take years, but some categories are actually easy to read just by flipping through some photographs. Now, Dr. Dehaene of College de France in Paris was examining MRI scans of the parietal lobe, where numbers are recognized, when one of his doc posts casually mentioned that just by quickly scanning the MRI pattern, he could tell what number the patient was looking at. In fact, numbers create distinct patterns on the MRI scan. This leaves open the question of when we might be able to have a picture quality videos of our thoughts. Unfortunately, information is lost when a person is visualizing an image. But brain scans corroborate this. When you compare the MRI scan of the brain when it's looking at a flower versus the MRI scan when the brain is thinking about a flower, you immediately see the second image has fewer dots than the first. So although this technology will vastly improve in the coming years, it will never be perfect. It reminds of a short story I once read where a man meets a genie who offers to create anything that a person can imagine. Now, the man asks for, of course, luxury cars, jet planes, and $1 million. And at first, the man's ecstatic, but when he looks at these items in detail, he sees that the car and the plane have no engine, the image of the cache is blurred, everything is useless. And it's because the memories are only approximations to the real thing. But given the rapidity with which scientists are beginning to code the MRI patterns in our brain, does this mean that we will soon be able to go beyond seeing the images to actually reading words and thoughts circulating in the mind? And that offers up a good question, because if this is the route that they're going, to ultimately have a full-on video of what you're thinking about, could there be a device in the near future that, I don't know, you strap to your head before you go to bed at night and record your dreams?
That would be the real, that would be, you could charge anything for that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the possibilities with that, because, I mean, everyone knows that when you're dreaming, everything makes sense to you, I guess, during your dream. But then you wake up and you're telling someone, well, I had this dream last night. I was in my house, but it wasn't my house, and this and that. And it's just like, well, yeah, that would be awesome to see what you were dreaming about, especially if the dream had to do with any type of, like, I don't know, fantasy. Like, you were flying around. You're like, I want to be able to see that video, because, and it begs the question, would it record it as if I'm watching, I could see a story on play, or would it be like I was watching somebody play one of those video games that's in, like, in third person? Am I seeing everything through your eyes? Because that's a question people sometimes ask when talking about dreams. Do you see everything that's going on, or are you seeing it through your own eyes? And I know in my dreams, I'm obviously seeing it through my own eyes, so I don't see myself standing there.
Right. I don't see myself standing there, but at the same time, I don't know the beginning or the end. Like, I'm just there.
Yeah, you're just there. You're experiencing it. And it's like, there was this guy. He was my father, but he wasn't. But in my dream, I knew he was.
Right. Or I was at work and I was yelling, or someone was yelling at me. Like, yeah. I think in psychotherapy, if you could record your dream, like if someone had the same dream, like I have this reoccurring dream.
Right.
I'm walking through this field. There's a big white house. And if the psychoanalyst could see the imagery of that dream, I think that they would be able to help the person that's having that dream out.
Oh, definitely. A very good friend of my dad's, he was a cop. And when he was a cop, he kept having the same reoccurring dream where he was getting called to this house. It was a breaking and entering situation. And he got out of his squad car and he slowly approached the door. And he could see that the door was just only open slightly. Now, every time he had this dream, he would open the door. And as soon as he opened it, there was a man on the other side of the door with a shotgun. And actually shot him. And, you know, that's what startled him awake. Oh, well, lo and behold, he actually got a call one night. He responded to it. And bang, there's the house in his dream. Backup hasn't arrived yet. He gets out of his car. He walks up to the front door. He sees it's ajar, just a little bit like it was in his dream. He said he went back to his squad car and waited for backup. He wasn't opening that door. I mean, if you had that reoccurring dream, you'd have to see that as almost like a premonition, I would think.
I would think so too, man. That's too much.
Right. So now let's see what we're going to be going into the reading of the mind.
Right. So, in fact, in a building next to Gallant's laboratory, Dr. Brian Pasley and his colleagues are literally reading thoughts, at least in principle. One of the postdocs there, Dr. Sarah Skopinski, explain to me how they are able to identify words inside the mind. The scientist used what is called an ECOG, electrocorticogram technology, which is a vast improvement over the jumble of signals EEG scans can produce. ECOG scans, or ECOG scans, are unprecedented in accuracy and resolution since the signals come directly from the brain tissue and do not pass through the skull. Of course, the flip side is that one has to remove a large portion of the skull to place a mesh containing 64 electrodes inside an 8-inch by 8-inch grid directly on top of the exposed brain.
No, thank you. No, thank you.
Luckily, these scientists were able to get permission to conduct experiments with ECOG scans on epileptic patients who were suffering from debilitating seizures. The ECOG mesh was placed on their brains while open brain surgery was being performed on them by doctors at nearby University of California at San Francisco. As the patient hears various words, signals from their brains pass through the electrodes and are then recorded. Eventually, a dictionary is formed, matching the word with the signals emanating from the electrodes in their brain. Later, when a word is uttered, one can see the same electrical pattern. It also means that if one is thinking of a certain word, the computer can pick up the characteristic signals and identify it. With this technology, stroke victims who are totally paralyzed may be able to talk through a voice synthesizer which recognizes the brain patterns of individual words they're thinking of. It might also be possible to have a conversation which takes place entirely telepathically. Not surprisingly, brain-machine interface has become a hot field, with groups around the country making significant brain breakthroughs. Similar results have been obtained by scientists at the University of Utah. They placed two grids, each containing 16 electrodes, over the facial motor cortex, which controls movement of the mouth, lips, tongue, and face, and also the Wernicke's area, which processes information about language. The person was then asked to say 10 common words such as yes and no, hot and cold, hungry and thirsty, hello and goodbye, more and less. Using a computer to record the brain signals when these words were uttered, they were able to create a rough one-to-one correspondence between spoken words and computer signals from the brain. Later, when the patient voiced certain words, they were able to correctly identify each one with accuracy between 75 and 90%. The next step is to use a grid with 121 electrodes to get a better resolution. In the future, this procedure may prove useful for individuals suffering from strokes, paralyzing illnesses such as Lou Gehrig's disease, who would be able to speak effortlessly using this brain-to-computer technique.
Well, that sounds very similar to, now, I don't know the exact technology behind it, but, the physicist, Stephen Hawking's, yeah. I think that he's got something similar to that, because you don't really see him typing. You just see him kind of, he's sitting there and his brain is thinking of what to say. And then the computer is analyzing it and speaks for him. And you don't ever hear him, the computer saying, no, that's not what I wanted to say. I wanted to say this.
Back up, delete.
Yeah. It's just like, this technology, I mean, has to be out there in some fashion. If that is in fact what he's doing now. They even go a little bit further, stating that not only are we reading the mind, that eventually that we can be typing with the mind. Now, at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, there's a doctor, Jerry Shi, who has hooked up epileptic patients via this ECOG sensors so they can learn how to type with the mind. The collaboration of this device is simple. The patient is first shown a series of letters and told to focus mentally on each symbol. Now, a computer records the signals emanating from the brain as it scans each letter. But as with other experiments, once this one-to-one dictionary is created, it is then a simpler matter for a person to merely think of a letter, and the letter would be typed on the screen using only the power of the mind. Now, Dr. Shi says the accuracy of this machine is nearly 100%. And next, Dr. Shi believes that he can create a machine which records images that patients conceive in their minds, not just words. This could have applications for artists and architects, but the big drawback of the ECOG technology, as we have mentioned, is that it requires opening up the brains of the patients, which, I mean, you know, you really got to feel for these people that are subjecting themselves to this, because they're obviously going through so much pain and suffering that they're just like, if it can be fixed by you taking the top part of my head off and doing these tests,
they're do desperate.
It. Oh, yeah. I mean, you can't blame them. I mean, people that are in just crazy pain. Now, they do have EEG typewriters because they are non-invasive and they're actually entering the marketplace. And they're not as accurate as the ECOG typewriters, but they have an advantage. They can be sold over the counter. Guger Technologies, it's a company that's based in Austria, recently demonstrated an EEG typewriter at a trade show. And according to their officials, it only takes 10 minutes or so for a person to learn how to use this machine. And then they can type at a rate of 5 to 10 words per minute, which doesn't seem like a lot. But if you're thinking about typing something on the screen, I mean, we'll just think about it. You're not thinking of the word and the words popping up. You're spelling the word. So until you visualize each individual letter in a sentence, I mean, that could take a while. And even the fact that it's translating onto the computer, I mean, that's amazing.
Right. And especially if you're using big words, apothecary, dictionary. You have to think of each individual letter, then the space in between them, and then, I mean, you're using your mind to put exactly what you want on the paper down. But leave it up to Americans.
Yeah.
They're lazy. You can't even type on a keyboard anymore.
I was watching a documentary recently called Our World Over the Next 50 Years. And it was basically the children of 50 years from now in this documentary were basically like, you had to actually touch the computer screen or touch the keyboard to get things in there. Just like, I can't even imagine what that must have been like, that you had to go through all that. And it's just like, wow.
It wasn't too long ago, 2007, when they introduced the iPhone. And before that, the touch screen was vastly different. And especially to be on such a small platform as a phone, when Apple released a phone that had a touchscreen that was as sensitive as the iPhone is, where you can pick each little part of the screen up and just touch it very gently. And now they have sensors that tell how hard you're touching it. So if you touch something and then push down on it a little bit harder, it opens the app even further and displays even more information. So touchscreen technology has only been around for the last 10 years. So right. now if we're going to take it one step further and go with telepathy technology, it's one of those slippery slopes, I think.
It is. And one of the things that I liked about the new Apple update that just came out, and it had something that we had talked about in a past podcast, and as soon as I saw it reminded me of the past podcast. I remember we were talking about cell phones and the fact that whoever came up with the technology for when you got in your car, it recognized the fact that you're in the car and it'll send out a message or something saying, hey, I'm driving right now, I'll get back to you and this and that. Well, that with this new update, that I got into my car on the first day I ran the update and it said, do you want to upload this program when you're driving to send this message? And I was like, yeah. I was like, oh, man. I was like, so, I mean, we're thinking of things that we think should be out there. And, you know, it's being worked on. So I can't even imagine what's really being worked on. Because as we were saying, as we were preparing for this show, all this information, this is information that's public knowledge. I mean, everything that we're discussing tonight can be researched. So if this is public knowledge, just think what's really out there for, you know, people in the, you know, the shadow government and such. Because I had heard a whistleblower that worked for the shadow government say one time that the technology that's out right now is between 70 and 100 years old, which would be like the equivalent of having the iPhone in like 1950. So they had those capabilities. So just imagine what's really out there.
And also, I'm sure that the telepathy is way more advanced in government applications, because if you were to think about first contact, if there was intelligent life that came to us, and extraterrestrials, the first contact would probably be through telepathy.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And that has a lot to do with when we were talking about James Forrestal in a recent podcast, where he was, quote-unquote, thrown out of a window. Well, one of the things that he had stated publicly was that one of the aliens in Area 51 that was still alive at the time communicating with him telepathically. And he had actually made that statement to the public. And I don't think it was a couple more days and he was dead. And a company actually went in to investigate this, and they were saying, you know, it was really odd for the window that he jumped out of, that on the windowsill there was scratch marks, like someone was trying to hold on to the window. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the way that you could communicate, if you just say orange and somebody's thinking it, that's one thing. But to telepathically put forth the actual like peeling of an orange and showing that particular color of orange, things can become so much more descriptive. And the sense of a smell, like to just telepathically communicate, so much more information can be pushed from one individual to the next, way more than you could use words to describe.
Yeah, because like imagine like in the future when this is perfected, or if we have the technology through some artificial intelligence that we can communicate telepathically, think how this could drastically help struggling relationships with couples that just have a hard time communicating with each other. You could just be like, you know what, I'm done with the word. This is how you make me feel. And you send that feeling to them, and they're just like, wow.
This next thing, I think, would be
perfect. Oh, okay, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
No, I just think it's a great application. I got a little something here on telepathy helmets.
Do it.
In science fiction, we often encounter telepathy helmets. Put them on, and presto, you can read other people's minds. The U.S. Army, in fact, has expressed interest in this technology.
Of course.
In a firefight with explosions going off and bullets whizzing overhead, a telepathy helmet could be a lifesaver, since trying to bark orders amid the sound and fury of the battlefield drowns out your voice. I can personally testify to this, being at fireworks shows over the 4th of July for my birthday. Man, when they're going off, you can't even talk to each other.
Right.
With a telepathy helmet, a soldier would mentally communicate with his platoon amidst all of the thunder and noise. Recently, the Army gave a $6.3 million grant to Dr. Gerwin Schalk at Albany Medical College, but the Army knows that a fully functional telepathy helmet is still decades away, says Schalk. Experiments with the ECOG technology, which, as we have seen, requires placing a mesh of electrodes directly on top of the exposed brain of epilepsy patients undergoing surgery. With this method, his computers have been able to recognize vowels and 36 individual words inside the thinking brain. In some of his experiments, he approached 100% accuracy. But at present, this is still impractical for the U.S. Army, since it requires removing part of the skull in a clean, sterile environment of a hospital. And even then, recognizing vowels and a handful of words is a far cry from sending urgent messages to headquarters in a firefight. But the ECOG experiment demonstrated that it was possible to communicate mentally on the battlefield. Another method is being explored by Dr. David Popel of New York University. Instead of opening up the skull of his subjects, he is using MEG technology, using tiny bursts of magnetic energy to zero in on specific regions of the brain. Besides its non-invasive nature, the advantage of MEG technology is that it can precisely measure fleeting neural activity, in contrast to the slower MRI scans. In his experiments, he's been able to successfully record electrical activity in the auditory cortex when people think silently of a certain word. But the drawback is that it still requires the use of large table-sized machines to generate the magnetic pulse. Obviously, one wants a method which is non-invasive, portable, and accurate. Dr. Popel hopes his work with the MEG technology will complement the work being done with the EEG sensors, but he admits that a true telepathy helmet is still several decades away because both MEG and EEG scans lack accuracy.
Wow. But just the fact that this type of advancement is being made is crazy. I mean, I think that I probably foresee it, you know, like you said, it's decades away, that I don't think people will necessarily have to wear helmets. I think it might be something similar. You go in for some surgery that's, you know, just in and out of the office, where they are connecting a microchip or something to some part of your cerebral cortex, that if somebody else has this chip, that you guys, it maybe not telepathy the way we think of it is, but these two computer chips are actually communicating back and forth and sharing thoughts. I mean, that would be close enough.
Dude, think about like the surgery on the knee. Remember when they had to like open the whole thing up?
Oh, yeah.
And then they just had the thing with the three little dots?
Yep.
So arthroscopic surgery.
Right.
Well, I mean, if they could just put a one sensor on one side and one sensor on the other side and then kind of read what happens in between the,
right,
the two sensors, that's an application, especially for a soldier. If you were thinking, I'm going to sign up for the Army, they now have telepathy where I can get my orders just through telepathy instead of hearing them on a battlefield being cried out.
Yeah.
That would be worth it. You'd just go in, have a little surgery, you know, have a little injection through the skull maybe. You probably wouldn't feel anything.
Right.
I don't think there's any nerve endings inside the skull. So even if they just had to drill like a little hole through it and then put a little patch over it, you would have your receptors in there. That would be cool.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely like to see the people that have it done first. I mean, I don't want to jump in line, but I'll tell you, but they must have something that's, you know, maybe in the dark government. But because I can remember when the stealth bomber first came out, that they were talking about that the pilots can fly the plane with their thoughts, and that they had, and there was something on their mask that could fire the weapons just by thinking about it and looking at the targets.
I definitely remember that from Airwolf.
Right.
They had the visor where the eyes would point to where the gun would point to where the eyes were going, and they could shoot the gun. Was that Apache helicopter?
Yeah.
Yeah. They had weapons on the Apache that they could use the visor to just use optics.
Yeah, so science fiction is becoming more realistic. And if you talk to anybody that travels in circles of ufology and extraterrestrials, and the question ever comes up, well, how did they get here? You know, I've heard a lot of people give their theories on it. Some of the best have been from Dr. Stephen Greer, and he basically says it all comes down to thought and consciousness. I mean, that even down to their spacecraft is self-aware. So it's responding to their every thoughts and everything. It's crazy. Now, imagine if we could try and get like an MRI down to like the size of a cell phone.
That's not in the new iPhone X.
No. So don't try scanning yourself, seeing what you can come up with. But at the present, one is hindered by a relatively crude nature of the instruments. But as time goes by, more and more sophisticated instruments will probe deeper into the mind. The next big breakthrough may be MRI machines that are handheld. Now, the reason why MRI machines have to be so huge right now is because you need a uniform magnetic field to get good resolution. Now, the larger the magnet, the more uniform you can make the field and the better accuracy one finds in final pictures. However, physicists know the exact mathematical properties of magnetic fields. And in 1993 in Germany, Dr. Bernard Blumeck and his colleagues created the world's smallest MRI machine, which is the size of a briefcase. Now, it has weak, you know, it is weak and it has a distorted magnetic field, but the supercomputers can analyze the magnetic field and correct for this so that the device produces realistic 3D pictures. Since the computer power doubles roughly every 18 months, they are now small and powerful enough to analyze the magnetic field created by the briefcase-sized device and compensate for its distortion. Now, as a demonstration of their machine, in 2006, they were able to take MRI scans of Otzi, the Iceman who was frozen in ice about 5,300 years ago toward the end of the last ice age. But because Otzi was frozen in an awkward position with his arms spread apart, it had proven impossible to scan him inside a small cylinder of the conventional MRI machine. But Dr. Blumeck, the portable MRI machine, easily took MRI photographs. Now, these physicists estimate that with increasing computer power, an MRI machine of the future might be the size of a cell phone. The raw data from this cell phone would be sent wirelessly to a supercomputer, which could process the data from a weak magnetic field and then create a 3D image. So the weakest of the magnetic field is compensated by the increase in the computer power. Now, this then could vastly accelerate research. Perhaps something like Star Trek tricorder is not so far off after all, Dr. Blumeck has said. Now, the tricorder is a small handheld scanning device that gives instant diagnosis of any illness. In the future, you may have a computer power in your medicine cabinet that in modern university hospital today. Instead of waiting to get permission from a hospital or university to use an expensive MRI machine, one could gather data in your own living room by simply waving the portable MRI over yourself and then emailing the results to the lab for analysis. It could also mean that at some point in the future, an MRI telepathy helmet might be physically possible with vastly better resolution than an EEG scan. So, we are definitely getting our MRI machines smaller, and it doesn't seem like it's becoming an issue because we're just going to send that information directly through Wi-Fi, I guess, to some supercomputer, which will then analyze the data and basically fill in the blanks, saying, okay, well, it was on a small scale, but if we ramp it up, this is exactly what it is, and then you're going to have your complete image or video or whatever it is. But, I mean, even with, you know, all these great technology advances or technological advances, you know, one has to also think, you know, is this technology ethical and can it produce, you know, privacy issues?
Right. There are some privacy issues. When hearing of mind-reading machines for the first time, the average person might be concerned about privacy. The idea that a machine concealed somewhere may be reading our intimate thoughts without our permission, it's unnerving. Fortunately, the laws of physics make it exceedingly difficult to decode brain scans from a distance. In school, we learn about Newton's laws and that gravity diminishes as the square of the distance, so that if you doubled your distance from a star, the gravity field diminishes by a factor of 4, but magnetic fields diminish much faster than the square of the distance. Radio signals degrade quite rapidly outside the brain, especially in uncontrolled environments. Most signals decrease by the cube or the quartic of the distance. So if you double the distance from an MRI machine, the magnetic field goes down by a factor of 8 or more. Furthermore, there would be interference from the outside world, which would mask the faint signals coming from the brain. This is one reason why scientists require strict laboratory conditions to do their work. And even then, they are able to extract only a few letters, words, or images from the thinking brain at any given time. So, unless someone is in a laboratory setting and just a foot or two away, the radio signals would be too diffuse and weak for anyone to make sense of them. And today's technology is not adequate to record the avalanche of thoughts that often circulate in our brain as we simultaneously consider several letters or words, phrases or sensory information. So using these devices for mind reading, as seen in the movies, is not possible today and for decades to come. For the foreseeable future, brain scans will continue to require close access to the human brain in laboratory conditions. But in the highly unlikely event that someone finds a way to read thoughts from a distance, you still have countermeasures that you can take. To keep most of your important thoughts private, you might have to use a shield to block brain waves from entering the wrong hands. This is done something called a Faraday cage. Invented by the great British physicist Michael Faraday in 1836, although the effect was first observed by Benjamin Franklin. Basically, electricity will rapidly disperse around a metal cage, so that the electric field inside the cage is zero. To demonstrate this, physicists sometimes enter a metallic cage and then fire huge electrical bolts at it. Miraculously, the physicists are unscratched. This is why airplanes can be hit by lightning bolts and why cable wires are covered with metallic threads. A telepathy shield would consist of thin metal foil placed around the brain.
Well, that seems pretty logical. I mean, because if you're using a Faraday cage to block any type of radio signal or brainwave activity, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, again, I'm going to go back to the stealth bomber because of the type of material that they put on the bottom of the stealth. It makes it undetectable by radar. So they're sending radio pulses or electromagnetic pulses out in there on their radar to locate this. It's hitting this surface that's probably similar to the Faraday cage, and it doesn't send a signal back. So it's
dispersing.
Yeah, it's just blocking it.
When we were talking about this in pre-show, Foles looked over at me and goes, tinfoil helmets?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought of. I mean, I was just like, well, that's obviously where this came from, was okay, we got to stop them from reading our minds. Now,
so great.
Now, covering the privacy issues. So if you're going to cover the privacy issues, then obviously you're going to have to ramp it up a bit and then discuss the legal issues of such technology. Now, for now, the real question is not whether someone will be able to read our thoughts secretly from remote concealed device, but whether will we be willing to allow our thoughts to be recorded. What if some unscrupulous person gets authorized access to, you know, your tapes of your recordings? There's a doctor by the name of Brian Paisley that says there are ethical concerns, not with the current research, but with the possible extensions of it. There has to be a balance. If we somehow are able to decode someone's thoughts instantaneously, that might have great benefits for thousands of severely disabled people who are unable to communicate right now. Now, on the other hand, there are great concerns if this were applied to people who didn't want that. Once it becomes possible to read people's minds and making recordings, then a host of ethical and legal questions will arise. Now, this happens whenever any new technology is introduced, and historically has taken years before the law is fully able to address their implications. Now, for instance, copyright laws may have to be rewritten. What happens if someone steals your invention by reading your thoughts? Can you patent your thoughts? Who actually owns the idea? Now, another problem occurs if the government gets involved. As John Perry Barlow, poet and lyricist for the Grateful Dead, once said, relying on the government to protect your privacy is like asking a peeping Tom to install your window blinds. Under interrogation, would the law be allowed to read your thoughts? Already, courts have been ruling on cases where an alleged criminal refused to submit his DNA as evidence. In the future, will the government be allowed to read your thoughts without your consent? And if so, will it be admissible in court? And how reliable would they be in the first place? In the same way the MRI lie detectors only measure increased brain activity, it's important to note that thinking about a crime and actually committing one are two different things. Now, under gross examination, a lawyer may argue that these thoughts were just random musings and nothing more. There is no law of physics which can resolve these ethical questions. Ultimately, as this technology matures, these issues will have to be settled in court by judges and juries. Now, going over that and stating the legal ramifications for this type of technology makes me think of the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report.
Right.
Because they had that technology, and if that thought even came into your mind, even, you know, you didn't even want that thought there. It was detected by the future law enforcement, and you were arrested and charged as if you did the crime, and they're saying that they were saving the planet by preventing the crime and keeping you locked up. That would be crazy.
Pre-crime.
Yeah, pre-crime.
Yeah, that's not right, man.
No, because that would be like if you were just joking around and be like, you know what, that guy really did me wrong. I'm going to kill that miserable, you know, and then the supercomputer is like, Foltz said he's going to kill this guy.
Foltz is a pre-murderer.
Yep, send SWAT.
They would have no way to lock all those people up. Because no. I'm sure there's millions of Americans that think about killing somebody.
It's
not going to happen.
Well, no, because all the thoughts of killing everybody are going to be turned on these people. They're going to be like, now we really got to get them because they don't want to kill us.
Right.
Now, I want to talk about something just real quickly. I don't think we can touch on this subject without mentioning physicist Michio Kaku, one of my favorites. But he was talking about telepathy and reading minds and telekinesis in a book that he put out within the last, I would say 3-4 years, that was on the bestsellers list, and it was called The Future of the Mind. And I'm just going to read you a little bit about what Michio Kaku had to say. Now, he states, when I was a kid, I was fascinated by science fiction and telepathy, reading minds and telekinesis, moving objects with the mind, and I would read stories about recording memories and becoming a genius and all these things. But I grew up and became a physicist and realized that was all nonsense until now. Now, because of advances in physics, we can actually peer into the brain and all things that I mentioned. Telepathy, telekinesis, uploading memories, recording memories, and even photographing a dream. These are things that we actually do in a laboratory. And I wanted to tell people the excitement that we feel knowing that these new advanced instruments of physics are literally prying open the thinking process. And somebody said, or he was being interviewed, and somebody asked, can you talk about telepathy and how this is demonstrated in a lab? And he said, yes. Now, here was his response to that. We have people who are paralyzed because of a stroke, or they have a war injury, or they lost a limb, and we can now put a chip the size of a dime on their brain, connect the chip to a laptop computer, and then these people can research the web by thinking. They can write emails, they can do crossword puzzles, they can operate a wheelchair, operate household appliances, and they can even operate mechanical arms and mechanical legs. The military, of course, is interested in this because it allows the wounded veterans to use mechanical arms and legs that they control mentally just by thinking about it. One of his colleagues, Dr. Stephen Hawking, the physicist, has lost control of his bodily functions and now communicates by thinking. There's a chip that picks up radio from his mind, decodes it, and then types it. You can now type by simply thinking about it. Well, there's our answer to that. So Stephen Hawking does have that technology.
It's unsettling if you watch him, like videos of Stephen Hawking, because his disease is such advanced stages, it just looks like he's in pain just sitting there.
Yeah.
I don't think that he is.
Yeah, that's the way his body goes.
He's atrophied to the point where it looks like that.
Right. Now, I just want to give one more quick thing on Dr. Michio Kaku, because he had stated in his book, he was talking about being able to upload memories in a laboratory to mice. And somebody or he was asked the question, how was memory uploaded to a mouse? And this was his response. He said, what they do is the memory is formed in the very center of the brain called the hippocampus. There are signals that go bouncing across the hippocampus, and you can record by putting two electrodes on either side of the hippocampus. You can then measure all the electrical impulses going back and forth. Then you put that on a tape recorder. You then tape the signals that go back and forth, and the mouse learns something new. Later, the mouse forgets, and then you put it back, and the mouse instantly remembers. So that's fascinating. Now, I had watched a documentary where he was explaining this, and they were actually using an injection where they were teaching these mice how to drink from the water bottle that's got the little ball in it for like gerbils. And they were letting the mice in there, and they were showing them the route to get to the water, and the mice remembered it, but only for a short time, because I guess the mice knew that we're not always going to be in this scenario. So just like the human brain does, it takes the information it doesn't need and protects you from it, and you forget. So then after enough time went by, they put these mice back in this maze or whatever, and none of them knew where the water bottle was and could seek it out. Well, they took this injection where they had originally removed, as those mice were learning where the water bottle was, they had a syringe in the hippocampus, and they were retrieving, I guess, some type of liquid or from the brain. And then when they wanted these mice to know where the water bottle was again and put them in this thing, they ejected that memory, that liquid that they took out, back into the hippocampus, and the mice ran directly to where the water bottle was. They could remember then.
That's unreal. Unreal, man.
It really is. This topic is fascinating in every sense of the word.
It always has. I remember telepathy and telekinesis was a huge part of my childhood.
Definitely.
I tried to use the force to move large rocks.
Oh, definitely. Or
tree branches. Hours when I was a child, I remember trying.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've done the experiment where you've tried telepathy, maybe with like your brother or sister or something.
Sure.
Like, what am I thinking right now?
Yep.
It's, I don't have it.
Right.
I would need the telepathy helmet, because every time I've ever done it, I've never come up with.
Right. I'm in the same boat too. And, you know, as a child, I always loved it as well. I was a big fan of the sci-fi 80s series V, where, you know, the lizards came down, the lizard people, and they used telepathy a lot to communicate with the humans and even with their own species. So I was always like, oh, that would be beast. If it gets to the point where people can just communicate that way, your whole education system is going to have to change, because you'll have a classroom there and you'd be thinking to yourself, Steve, what's the answer to number 8? I have no clue. And you're like, it's apparatus courthouse. So, but yeah, I mean, it's a great topic, and I love that, you know, we're not that far out of the realm of the actual known. I mean, a lot of our topics have to do with the unknown, but with this specific topic, I mean, we're making great advances in what could possibly be one day that we don't even need our vocal cords anymore. Maybe they'll atrophy, because all we're doing is communicating telepathically.
Doesn't seem that far off with the information we provided tonight, with the sensors going directly onto the brain and all of the advances that they're making scientifically. It just doesn't seem like it's that far off.
Yeah, I mean, what it'll be like in 100 years from now, I think it'll be unrecognizable. Our grandchildren's children will be, I don't know, aliens, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to look at us like we're prehistoric stone
age. Well, sure. It'll be like, you know, when we were talking to our grandparents that grew up during the Depression. We were like, oh, gosh, there was no TV. And, I mean, my children have grown up in a generation where they've never known without an internet. So when I explain to them sometimes, I'm just like, you guys don't understand how good you have it.
Right.
We had to go to the library to do these reports and this and that. And it's just
100 years ago, there was no cars.
Yeah.
70 years ago, there was no airplanes.
Yep.
We landed in the moon in 69.
Yeah.
Things progress so fast. We're going to be speaking telepathically. Probably in our lifetime.
Yeah. I mean, that would be, I would love to see it. I would love to see the technology unfold and just see what forms are out there. I think it could be amazing. So
I loved having this conversation with you.
I did too. I had a lot of fun. I'm glad that we're back in the studio. We're going to be putting out regular podcasts every week again, God willing. But we just want to say we appreciate you guys hanging in there with us during Subtle Beast time of need to take care of personal family issues. And we're going to continue to put out some good information for you all coming up. And I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we had putting it on for you, because it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So, until next time, I'm Foltz.
And I'm Steve.
And we'll see you next time. Take care of one another. Bye-bye.